This is an interview with Sergeant James Sanditelli for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program at the U.S. Army Reserve Center in Farrell, Pennsylvania on February 14th at approximately 1:30 p.m. History Program. Okay, Sergeant Sanditelli. Today I'd like to begin by asking you how you came to be in the military.
Well, when I was 17 years old, I got patriotic enough. I just wanted to join the military. Off and on for the last 30-some years. I've been in and out of the military.
Okay, can you tell me the date of when you entered?
May 1954.
And where did you go for your basics?
Well, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay, and can you tell me what a typical day was like there?
Well, being a young recruit like that, everybody was like scared to death, you know. So normally we didn't know what was going to happen to us until we got into our third week of basic training, and then we started getting into a routine. And it was rough. But back then, it's not the same type of armed military situation you have today as you had back 30 years ago. So it was like ask why. That's mostly what it consisted of. Then from there, we moved on to school. Then after school, you would get to a permanent change of station, which was normally where you stayed at. My permanent duty station was Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Okay. What was your actual trained occupational skill?
Well, my first one in, back in 54, I went in as a truck driver.
Okay.
Yeah, I mostly just drove truck at that time. I was pretty excited about being a truck driver. Then in later years, I decided I wanted to change my specialty, and I went into finance and accounting.
Okay.
And worked with dislocation allowances and travel pay.
How long were you at Fort Dix?
Well, I was at Fort Dix from 1954 till October of 1955, and I went to Korea for almost 17 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What's going on
now? I was in Korea. That sort of like ended my military career. Then I got out.
Okay.
And then went back in and I stayed out of the military for a while, then I went back in 1963.
Okay.
See, I got in 57, went back in 63.
Okay.
And I stayed until 66, and that's when my Vietnam duties came up.
Okay. What made you re-enlist?
Work. There was no work on the outside.
Really?
Yeah. So it was like, looking for a job, and it was just rough to get a job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in 63, before you went back into the military, was there any talk about Vietnam in like the outside, or was it much of an issue? Or?
Not that I can remember. Okay, it was talk about Southwest Asia, and Southeast Asia, rather. And it was, these rumors, like you always hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing was certain. Of course, we were in Vietnam for a long time. We were back in the 50s. Matter of fact, we had troops over there. We never expected anything like this was going to happen at that time.
By the time you re-enlisted, you really didn't have anything. It wasn't on your mind at all?
No, because Vietnam wasn't there. And naturally, when I went back in, I had to go through basic training over again, so I had to go to Fort Dix, New Jersey for basic training. Then I went to Fort Ben Harrison, Indiana for finance and accounting. I went to Korea again.
Okay.
So like, I always ended up in Korea. I don't know why. So I was over in Korea for a year. Came home, went to Fort Benning, Georgia. And I was down at Fort Benning for a year. Then I was with the 11th Air Assault Division. So it was deactivated. And they made the first aircraft mobile.
Okay.
So that's when we went to Vietnam, in that division.
Before you actually got to where to go, how did you find out?
Well, we didn't know for sure. It was just like April 65. It was rumored that the air unit was going to be deactivated, and the first cab, it was going to be replace us, paperwork-wise. So we didn't know for sure what was going to happen, and everybody had their own theory on what was going to happen to us. But when it was official, the orders came down, and we figured, well, that year, we were going to be gone. We were going to be at home, and we knew for sure.
Okay, once you knew, did you go through any additional training or anything to get you ready for it?
Yes, we went through jungle training.
Really? Right.
It wasn't much of much. It wasn't much jungle training because they didn't have the expertise that they had back there when the guys were coming in the military in the 70s. Okay, in the early 70s, that's when they started having the jungle warfare school down in Fort Benning, Georgia, and over in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really know too much about what was going to happen.
So where did you get your training then? You stayed?
Fort Benning, Georgia.
You stayed there?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you tell me, just along the line, what kind of things they taught you?
Well, most of it was escape and evasion.
Really?
That's the main thing. The main thing with us was about being captured. And we went through all kind of classes I can't remember what they called the classes. I can't remember so long ago. Land navigation.
Okay.
Okay, a lot of land navigation classes. There was a lot of if you got captured and what to do when you got captured. You know, we went through all kind of training on that. And camouflage and concealment. So it was pretty routine stuff we had to go. In other words, we were doing more of a refresher course and refreshing our minds on stuff that we did learn back in basic training.
Okay. Now, in your occupation going over, were you expecting to see combat, or were you expecting to go like a base or your area?
No, we expected to see combat.
Really?
Yeah, because we heard before we're going to move up into the jungle, so we were like 280 miles north of Saigon up in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew right away that we were going into a hazardous situation up there.
Mm-hmm. What kind of attitudes did that give you in the unit on the way over?
It was pretty good morale. The morale was pretty good, yeah. Everybody was, everybody knew each other. It was like a big family, you know. And, you weren't with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody felt that, more of a camaraderie thing.
You think that made a difference compared to some of the units where they just took people out as they needed them and shipped them out sort of piecemeal?
Yes, it did. Made a big difference. Made a big difference on you.
Okay, when you got there, where did you first land at? You went over by plane?
Yeah, I went by plane. I was in a rear echelon. Uh-huh. And my company went over on a ship.
Okay.
The whole division went by ship.
Okay.
They went from Oakland, California, the San Francisco area, Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And they went by the ship went to Hawaii, and from Hawaii, I guess they went on to Saigon. And we went over by C-130, and we landed at four different places in the States, and we went to Hawaii, Wake Island, and Philippines.
Okay, which airport did you come in via?
Tonsonut. Yeah.
And you remember what the date was?
It was the end of August.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which year is this?
65. Yeah.
Okay. What was your first impression when you got off the airplane?
Well, getting off of C-130, you're in an area. I think we landed in Quinon. We landed in Quinon. It was just like it was a dirt airstrip down there. And from there we went by chopper to Latrang, and from Latrang we went by chopper Chinooks. It was a big big helicopters. We went into the Central Highlands up there in the jungle. We just landed in the middle of the jungle. There was nothing there. First thing I seen when I got off that chopper was a Buddha, pagoda type thing, you know, staring right at me. What do we do now? Here we are. So we made our way down, had a trail going down to our base camp. And we ended up in the base camp up there. Nobody was actually scared. There was nothing going on at that time.
Really, there wasn't any worries or anything going up by helicopter?
No, we had no... Not as if somebody would run in 69 or 70. You know. Mm-hmm. That's when things were really hot and heavy then. But I was fortunate enough to be there at the beginning. I'm going to say fortunate. Nobody was fortunate to be there. I mean, it was just a terrible situation.
What was the name of the base camp?
It was up at On K. It was called Camp Radcliffe.
Okay. How big was it?
No, it was a pretty big area. It was a pretty big area. Yeah, we our company was located right at the bottom of Hong Kong Mountain. They call it Hong Kong Mountain down there. The area stretched out pretty good.
Right.
We had a place called Gulfport area. Other areas were sat back, and the perimeter was so big that you just couldn't get around the whole area, because we had artillery, we had infantry, artillery, helicopters. We had an LZ site there, which was a landing zone. We had a medevac company right next to us.
Right.
They had medevac choppers, and then we had five flying cranes. There were only five of them in the world at that time. We got all five of them over there.
Do you remember what the designation on the flying crane was? Number-wise?
I don't know if it was an AH something.
Really?
AH, yeah, something. I can't remember exactly.
Okay.
I think we got an enormous, one enormous bug. It looked like. They used to pick up, they had field hospitals. They should transport the field hospital right out to the field with the flying cranes. My friends of mine were on a flying crane. They got killed. They were shot down hauling small arms fire. They had small arms, which consisted of 5.56, 7.63 ammunition, pyrotetrics, and frags and everything else. And they just, well, it was like a gigantic net. They picked it up and were hauling it off to an area. And they got shot down.
Okay, can you remember what some of the defenses of the camp were
like? The only perimeters I knew were the ones around our area. We had a set of barbed wire. We had a minefield area outside the barbed wire. We had trip flares set up.
Now, was that the individual unit's responsibility in that area, or was there an overall?
Yeah, that was the individual's responsibility of the unit itself to do that. And there's things that called strip maps that we made up, okay, of areas that were mined. And because the infantry used to send out patrols on the other side of the perimeter line, and we had to be careful that we didn't end up shooting at them. Communications was a big thing with passwords and everything else.
Right. Okay, on the base, can you remember what the majority of the infantry types were like? Were they Marines or were they Army?
Army. Around our area, it was all regular Army.
Okay, they didn't mix.
Now, the Marines were in different landing zone areas, and a lot of them were up around Da Nang. Da Nang, fire bases all over the area. They had fire bases everywhere. Mm-hmm. Special Forces had their own fire bases. The Marines had their own fire bases.
Mm-hmm.
We're scattered all over the country.
Okay, and what was your job at the base?
Okay, my job was taking care of the incoming soldiers, taking care of their records and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what my company was. It was an administrative company.
Mm-hmm.
And we took care of that. And a couple times, well, we had to leave the area sometimes. We had to move out to different areas. And uh, We ended up up in the Idrine Valley, doing a firefight up there in November 65.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but we got in and out of it real fast. It was all hell broke loose up there. But we didn't get to stay there too long. I ended up in the train. I was with 5th Special Forces down in the train. I was down there for about a month or so for my temporary duty assignments. And we moved out pretty good. We then went to different locations.
Okay. When you were on duty from the base camp, did you travel armed?
All the time.
All the time.
We were tactical every minute of the day. Mm-hmm. We used to get mortared almost every night.
Really? Yeah. What kind of weapons did you carry?
M16s.
How about things like grenades? Well, could you give me a basic rundown of what kind?
Yeah, we didn't have to carry any grenades with us. We had them stored. Mm-hmm. Okay. All we carried was our M16s, bayonets. That was about it. We wore steel pots and our what I call our LBE, which is consists of our suspenders and our pistol belts with our ammo patches. We carried 140 rounds of ammunition while you're in base camp. And when you left base camp, they would issue more ammunition. And sometimes they issue you out hand grenades.
Like the times where you're on assignment, like with the special forces and stuff, did you beef up your armor there, or did you?
I got it down there.
They supplied you?
Yeah, they supplied us down there.
Was the armament basically the same?
Yeah. Yeah, it was mostly the same. And down there, I felt safer down there with special forces than I did up where I was at.
Oh, really?
Yeah, those guys are pretty good. We went down there and we watched them. They trained the Montagnards. The Montagnards are the mountain people in Long. They used to train them down there. And them people were very, 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 very precision with crossbows. So I'm glad they were on our side. They were pretty good.
Did you have much contact with the Montagnards?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, down there in the train, I think.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of them personally?
They're just like anybody else. I mean, they're human beings that try to survive. You know, they're survivors in their own country, because the Vietnamese didn't want them. Mm-hmm. They're just like the Kurds are to the Iraqis, the same way. And a lot of the mountain people probably wiped their existence out by now. But they're good fighters. They're good fighters.
Okay, how long were you in Camp Radford?
I was there about 7 months.
Okay. Where did you go after that?
I got out.
That was when you were done?
Yeah, but my ATS was up and I came home.
Okay. Little things little things, but when the camp was mortared at night, what was the usual procedure?
We had bunkers.
You had bunkers?
Yeah, we built bunkers up there, and then we used to hit the bunkers almost every night.
Really?
Yeah, they were coming after us pretty good.
Did you have any kind of warning, or was it just the first show?
I don't know. It's just nobody knew. It just happened. sometimes they would send up a flare, and sometimes the enemy would send a flare up, and sometimes they had mortars in what they called had a treetop burst on them. Okay, it was like an umbrella type thing. They exploded above you, and all the shrapnel came down on you. That's what we had to watch. That's the most, that was really scary. Mm-hmm. We lost a couple guys in our unit like that.
Right. Okay, what were your bunkers like? Were they roofed, or were they just...
They were sandbagged. They went down. We dug down pretty far as we could go before we hit the shell and rock. Mm-hmm. Then we sandbagged them. Everything was sandbagged. We put a parapet over the top, and we sandbagged the top of them.
So are they basically pretty much safe as long as you're inside it?
Yeah. We never had any collapse. Of course, if they would have had artillery, they would have fired artillery on us, and that might have made a difference. But the mortars, I can't remember any of our bunkers ever getting hit by mortar.
Uh-huh.
Tents, yeah.
Okay, Well, I mean, did the camp ever take any assaults or anything, or was it just...
One time we did.
Really?
One time we had an assault on the camp, and we beat them off a little bit.
Could you tell me more details on what that was like?
I can't tell you because, number one, is it happened at night, it was raining, it was during the monsoon weather, and we didn't know what the hell was happening. All we know is the choppers came in and ran them off.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we had an airstrike, they came in, they hit them, and it lasted for about 2.5 hours. But you couldn't tell anything. I mean, there was nothing out there, couldn't see nothing. Everything was pitch black out, and they just seemed to knew what, they knew exactly where we were at. Which used to baffle me. I think during the day they put what they call, they used to put markers up. They use these markers and use it for mortars. They count off so many steps. Well, we didn't leave any Vietnamese in our areas. They must have done this, sneaking through the areas or something.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's another question. You say you didn't have any Vietnamese national personnel in the camp at all?
Mm-hmm. Never seen any. I didn't even trust the Vietnamese soldiers.
Really?
I didn't trust any.
How about them? Do you have them in your camp?
They used to go through the area. Yeah. Yeah. They would pass by and take the road by or something. And you kind of figure that's what they were setting up there.
Right. You noticed maybe a correlation between when they went by and when your mortar attacks occurred,
yeah,
or how accurate they were.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of Vietnamese soldiers were actually communist soldiers. They were super spies.
How did the jungle training they gave you, did it help you at all?
No.
In the camp situation?
No, it didn't. No, just for the, for being captured.
Mm-hmm.
That was most of the thing, don't worry about being captured. Mm-hmm. They scared you so bad going through that training, you didn't want to get captured.
Mm-hmm. I think that was part of the point, maybe, of the training?
Yeah. Yeah. If you even thought about it, just put goosebumps up your back.
Mm-hmm.
Things that could happen to you. You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, the camp sounded like it was pretty substantial size. Mm-hmm. Was there ever that worry of being overrun or being captured?
I never worried about it.
Really?
Yeah, I never worried about it. We had a pretty good defense.
Mm-hmm.
We had an Air Force ship there too.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, we could fly C-130s in. That was the biggest plane we could fly in. The C-130s are props, the C-135s are jets. They tried to land a 135 there one time and it crashed into my side. right before I was getting ready to come home, the plane, I was supposed to be on this C-130, they shot it down as it was taking off. It was shot down, everybody wanted to get killed. And my wife had almost had a heart attack over there. She thought I was on the plane.
Like when they shoot that size airplane down, is it small arms or they manage to get something bigger in there?
Probably heat-seeking missiles. They
really?
Used. Yeah.
So you saw them every once in a while?
Yeah, they had them. They used them.
Okay, when you mentioned you said the helicopters chased them. Let me go back a little bit. Were they helicopters from your base or were they called in from the other?
No. Our bases, we were loaded with choppers up there. UEs, we had a lot of UEs. Sometimes we had to replace some of the door gunners on the Hueys. But if we were going somewhere, we had to go someplace, they wouldn't send, you would be the door gunner on an M60.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you would go yourself. Because the manpower was like a shortage of manpower sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there would be other choppers out, they're out doing the missions, and had all their crew chiefs on there and their door gunners, and sometimes we used to have to replace them.
Right.
No, everybody was proficient in 60 cal, M60, you know, the machine guns, M16s.
Okay, did you ever ride door gunner?
A couple times, yeah.
What was that like?
Not too bad. It was an experience. Yeah.
Were you strapped on the side? Was there a restraining strap on you?
No, we just sat, we sat on, actually what I did, okay, you could have, there was a safety harness on there you could use. And if you were going to fire, some guys hung their feet out the doors on the rudders. And they used that for brace. Some of them just fired a 60 from the door. Because everybody will settle under steel pots. Because you don't want to sit down on the floor of the plane. If bullets were coming up through the bottom of the floor, right, you want to make sure you had something between you and the floor. I know a guy got shot right in his butt on it.
Okay, when you were a flying gun gunner, did you ever actually have to shoot?
No, not really.
Really?
No. They tested the weapons sometimes, just fire them off, tested them. But the only time we ever got fired at in a plane, I remember, was when I was coming home.
Really?
Flying out of Torrance-Newton on a C-141. We got fired, pick up small arms fire. We could see out of the portals of the plane. Mm-hmm. You could see the flashes down below. Yeah, so it was scary. That was scary, especially when you're going home.
Yeah. Think it's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, like when, go back to the base a little bit. And like when you took arms fire with incoming aircraft and mortar fire, how did the base respond? Did they send out strike teams right after?
No, we had infantry, okay, units that ran our perimeter line for us.
Okay.
Right. Those guys were there every day, 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Even at night, they were there. We always had a patrol out there, an infantry patrol. Well, they were usually in the thick of it when stuff like this happened. But we took about 4 or 5 casualties one night, and we killed some vehicle in the process, climbing over the barbed wire fence, and probably killed about 8 monkeys one night.
Really?
Yeah. They tripped our trip flares. Hit the trip flares off, and once one of the trip flares goes off, that's it. And the perimeter line, they just fire everything. They just start firing. Which is bad. They should have waited to find out who the hell tripped it off first. Fair enough, we killed about 8 monkeys. Sometimes it would rain for a half hour. And you'd probably get about almost a foot of rain. That's fast. It would come down and it would stop. And it would get so hot, it was unbelievable. And the weather would just get a turnaround. We were in the Central Highlands. We were pretty far from the coastline. So when we got hit, it was just coming through. You know, it didn't stay too long. It just came through and out, dumped on us, and that was it.
This time, did you still have a dirt runway?
Yeah, what they did, the Air Force laid up metal runway, they could call it. It's a landing pad they laid up. But they did that. I mean, they took care of that. I don't know if we had nothing to do with that. But they never cemented no pads. Matter of fact, when we dug for water, we were building a shower. We had to go down so far, and we had a huge dynamite to blow the shell out, because there was a lot of rock. Okay. Right below the mine, there was a lot of rock down. There was water down. And we got enough water so we could pump it out and build showers. You'd be surprised how efficient you can be if you had it there. There are different things you can do.
Okay. I'm a little scattered here, but when the enemy that the patrols and people at the camp had to worry about, were they all Viet Cong, or did you ever notice any NVA mixed in, or was there any rumors of that?
No, the NVA never came into our area. It was mostly the ones we have, the Cong, they were mostly farmers. Okay, and they were, I can say you could see them out there farming during the day. But at night, they became Viet Cong. It was that simple. Yeah. Maybe after I had left there, because my unit got split up.
Right.
Yeah, they scattered all over the countryside, and I don't even know if RMK even existed after that.
Okay. Okay. Some of the standard questions I'm asking just to get sort of a statistical type of thing. One of the things that always comes up in reference to Vietnam is drug usage. Mm-hmm. At this time, either in basics or later on, I think, did you notice any of it?
No. No. That was in the later years of Vietnam. Yeah, and I heard guys talking about getting marijuana, you know, buying a pack of pack of cigarettes of marijuana, right, for a buck. And I smoked at that time, which I don't smoke anymore, but I smoked at that time, but I didn't smoke. I never had any marijuana. I was definitely afraid of stuff, you know. Just like, you didn't know what the hell you were getting into. You'd be smoking something and end up some kind of poison in it or something. I got sick over there from eating food, which I shouldn't have ate. I got dysentery real bad. Almost killed me. So there was stuff, you go in the village and you think you're eating chicken, it turns out to be rat.
Okay, did you get leave at all often? Or?
No. I didn't take any leave at all over there.
Really? So?
I got down to Saigon for R&R a couple times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how did that work?
Well, they drew your name out of a hat.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where they worked it for the beginning, because I guess they want to start off. You know, it's different sections.
Mm-hmm.
Now, different sections, they would have like two people a month to go in R&R. And they picked your name out of a hat. Which guys already went, their name was in there. You know, you end up being last, and you know, you're going on R&R for about a weekend or something. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys took leave and went to Australia.
Really?
Some guys went to Thailand. You know, I wanted to go to Australia, but I never did. I just didn't get a chance.
Really? Okay, on your R&Rs, where did you usually go for those?
Down to Saigon.
What was your impression of Saigon?
It wasn't too bad. It was a big city, you know. And we went down to, everybody used to go to Tudor Street, which was where all the bars were. Okay, and they had a big Continental Hotel down there with a restaurant, an outside restaurant. You know, just like the French put most of the ethics on restaurant, diner, and everything else, you know, and because the French were there for many years. And we call it Chante, over in Paris, they have a Chante, kind of like, I can't remember what they called it, but it was like outdoor cafes and everything down there. It was nice. It wasn't, you know, it was clean. We got to the outskirts around the suburbs, it was bad. You ran into dirt roads and stuff like that, and then you had to really watch yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went on R&R, did you go armed?
Yeah, we had to turn our weapons in. Down there, yeah. And when we got down to Saigon, then we had to turn our weapons in. And when we left, we picked our weapons back up.
Was there ever any nervousness or uneasiness in
no,
going
shit,
around?
No, we weren't worried about nothing. We went there and had a good time.
Really?
That was it. We weren't worried about nothing. We were down in Saigon, right? That place became a hotspot after a while. Right? When I left there, when I was there, they blew a couple of hotels up there. Satchels, car bombs, stuff like that. You go into a hotel, it's all sandbagged out, and you got machine guns set up on the outside.
Okay, another standard question is racial touching. Did you notice anything either, even back as far as boot camp or anything going through?
No, there was a little bit, yeah. It was in different individuals. It was an individual thing.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't a group thing. It was an individual thing. You always have that. And it's, you know, as much as people try to say no, it's here. You know, we try to calm the situations down a lot, you know. And it happens, it still happens in the world. You know? But you always have that individual that's, whether he be black or white, he always has that prejudices, you know, which you try. Hey, we lived together. We fought together. We died together. And everybody knew this. When it came down to combat, it was a different situation. But then you always had that after work thing, you know. Yes. And blow off steam sometimes, you know, and it happened.
Yeah, was that mostly at the camp, or did you notice it on leave or anything?
No, I never noticed it on leave. At camp, people get tensed up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Stress.
Yes.
And it could be two white guys yelling at each other and starting a fist fight, or it could be a white guy and a black guy, or two black guys. It didn't make any difference. It was stress. It was frustration, stress, and everything else. And these guys were just, they're blown off steam. And stuff happened.
Okay, you were in charge. Well, your job was basically bringing new people in. Do you have an idea of how many people that were coming through?
No, you couldn't possibly count. You couldn't count. It was unreal. We had records stacked up, this whole room stacked up this high full of records. It wasn't rooms in a tent, but because we had more KIAs and MIAs coming in, records coming in, and new people processing constantly. We worked 24 hours a day. It wasn't an eight-hour day job. It was 24-hour day, 7 days a week.
Now, with this many people coming in, were they using basically Radcliffe as a base camp and then sending them other places, or were they doing small maneuvers from there and coming back using...
First cab was, that was the first cab's base camp.
Okay.
And what anybody else did down in Saigon, or I don't know, I could tell you. 101st had their own, 82nd had their own base camps, in processing. Yeah, we just handled the first cab. Good, we had bad. I mean,
okay.
I'm not going to stand. I just can't answer that question right now.
Okay. What rank were you this time?
Sergeant.
You were sergeant then?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you ever run into any troops from other countries, like Australia or Britain?
Oh, yeah. Koreans, Tiger Division. I ran into some Australian soldiers over there. The Bush soldiers, they call them. That's about all for anything else in Vietnam.
What was your impression of the Koreans, having spent time in Korea? Your impression of the ones?
Different situation. In Korea, they didn't impress me at all.
Right.
Over in Vietnam, they impressed me because they were like kids at a candy store. They could get away with more stuff than we could get away with. And they did too.
Okay. You said you left after 7 months. Was your tour actually up then?
No, my enlistment was up.
Your enlistment was up?
Yeah.
Okay, where did you go from there?
Came home. I got out of the Army.
You came straight up.
Yeah.
Okay, when you got home, what was your impression of the general atmosphere regarding Vietnam?
Very, very hostile.
Really?
Very hostile.
Did you notice a lot of, having been a veteran and just coming out, did you get a lot of slack personally from people?
Sometimes, yeah. Some of my neighbors.
Really?
Yeah. It was a very, very bad situation, and as the years went on, it got worse.
Okay, I'll get on that too. When you're there towards the end of your tour, you're processing the new guys coming in. Did you notice any of those attitudes carrying over into the military, the new personnel coming in?
Not really, because you process them in so fast. that all you had is like asking basic questions: name, rank, serial number, date of place of birth, when did you arrive in country, and stuff like history. That was it. You know, and we could just move along to the next guy, you know, just keep moving. It was like a conveyor belt.
Okay. You got done, though. Can you remember what the date was?
I think it was March. I remember sometime in March.
Okay, you're in the reserves now. How did you come back to be in reserves?
I came back 1983.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What made you decide to come back then?
Job.
Really?
Another time I needed a job, right? I lost my job and I was looking for another position somewhere and it just wasn't there. So I thought, I'm going to try to get back in the military. So I came in the reserves, 1983 and 1985, and came back on active duty.
All right. They make you go through boot camp again?
No.
I was going to say.
No. I thought they were, but they didn't. So now I got 2.5 years to go to retire and that's it.
Right.
I hope.
Okay. As a civilian, basically, once you got back, what were your impressions? Did you follow the war on the media and stuff like that?
Well, still a lot of buddies of mine were over in Vietnam at that time. Yeah.
What was your impression of the way the media was portraying it as compared to what you knew from Vietnam?
It wasn't so much that the media was portraying the war. It was what the media was portraying the protesters out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was more emphasis on protesting than there was on the lives of the soldiers over and all the military that was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had all these activists who were doing all this, and they were causing more harm than they were causing good. That's why the situation went the way it went.
Okay, what was the feeling when you were over there, especially towards when you were ready to leave, about how the war was going among the military people?
We didn't know how the war was going.
Really?
We never did. Not until you come home and take another look at it. The people back home knew more about what was going on than we did. And we really didn't know that much about it. All we know is we thought that we could be in and out of every 6 months. That's what I thought about it.
Okay, when did you start to realize that the world wasn't going to be that way?
No, on the way home.
Really, on the way home?
That the situation was going to last for a while.
Okay, go back to the media end of it. Was there a point where you thought we weren't going to be able to win it? Or was there ever a point?
No, we didn't lose the important Vietnam.
I don't think so either, but
We didn't lose it. We turned it over to the South Vietnamese. They did the turnaround. They left their positions. They let the enemy come in.
Mm-hmm. Now,
we never did.
When you knew that was going to happen later on towards the end, did you realize that that's probably what was going to happen? Did you think that they could actually hold
it? It was inevitable. You could see it. You know, it was nothing. When we started saying we're going to pull our troops out of Asia, okay, then we knew for a fact that the Ho Chi Minh and his gang was coming. They were coming in. That's all there was to it. We couldn't do nothing about it because we weren't in it.
Okay. One of the areas I researched into was the Tet Offensive. You would have been a civilian at the time.
Yeah.
What was your perspective of it, having been in the military and seeing this?
It was something that should have never happened. Okay, because a very good friend of mine got killed in Hue during the Tet Offensive, January 68. And we're lucky that we didn't have more casualties. It should have never happened. It was like, it's hard to say something about the Tet Offensive because the strategy. Ho Chi Minh, he's a strategist anyway. He prepared this prepared this in advance. If we knew this was going to happen, it would have never happened. But it was really, he caught us with our pants down.
Really?
Yes, he did.
Okay, that's all the prepared questions I have at the moment. Is there anything you'd like to add? Any stories or anything you can think of? Or anything I didn't cover?
There's a lot of stories that have to be told about the Vietnam War. And, when you lose people that you live with for certainly a year or so, you become friends and that stuff like that, it's kind of hard because the only thing you can relish right now is your memory. And I have quite a few friends I lost over there. It's a story that you can't tell without getting emotionally involved. And this is the first time I talked about this for a long time. That's why the best thing ever happened to the Vietnam veterans was when they got the Vietnam Tomorrow Council situation over the Vietnam Vet Centers. Because we got to sit down and talk with each other about different things that happened to us. And everybody knew what you could relate to because everybody was there. That's why it's so hard to talk to somebody who's never there. One thing I do have to say, I'm really, really disgusted about it, is the fact of the embargo. Lifting the embargo over there. We still have 2,200 POWs, MIAs, that we haven't received back here. And everybody should be upset about that. Not only the families of the POW MIAs, but the people in general, the American people in general should really be upset about that because the Vietnamese have not dealt with us in good faith. Now the holy dollar is taken over for Budweiser, Pepsi Cola, Coca-Cola, whoever wants it, General Electric and all these other companies. You can't boycott all these companies. You would like to, but everybody's tramping over each other to get into Vietnam. I'm very disappointed in our country, I really am. This Vietnam issue is very disappointed in our establishment. I'm disappointed in the fact that they did what they did. Because, believe you me, you mark my words, I'm not going to bring back any more POWs or MIA bones or whatever because they lifted the embargo. That's not going to happen. You cannot trust the Vietnamese government. Everybody's thinking about how much money I can make on this deal. That's what I have to say. That's my feelings about that situation.
I know there's a lot of people that agree with you. Well, thank you very much for your time.
No time.
I appreciate
it. Yeah, my pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Well, we get it.